You're probably familiar with the concept of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It's the burden of proof the prosecution must satisfy to secure a conviction of a criminal defendant. But the odds are you're unfamiliar with the idea of residual doubt. Here's Patrick Mulvaney, the managing attorney for capital litigation at the Southern Center for Human Rights.
What we see is that there's a difference between a jury making a decision beyond a reasonable doubt and a jury disposing of all doubt. And it's that gap in between all doubt and reasonable doubt that we come up with the concept of residual doubt, where a jury can reach a guilty verdict at the guilt phase, but still have some doubt as to the defendant's guilt when it reaches the penalty phase. Because of that doubt becomes a powerful factor that weighs in favor of life at the penalty phase.
Empirical research shows there's good reason for such residual doubt. In Florida, there have been 29 death row exonerations. Robert Dunham and his team at the Death Penalty Information Center dug into those numbers.
In Florida, we were able to identify the jury votes in 22 of the cases in which there were exonerations. And in 20 of those 22, there were non-unanimous jury votes for death, either judicial override or a majority but not unanimous jury recommending the death penalty. And looking back on it, that makes sense, because one of the most powerful mitigating circumstances in capital cases is residual doubt.
And this takes us to the second meaning of residual doubt. No state currently allows for judicial override, a now abandoned procedure whereby a majority of jurors could vote for a life sentence, followed by the judge overriding that vote and imposing a death sentence. And yet, there are still inmates in two states in death row as a result of judicial override, five in Florida and a few dozen in Alabama. This new undisclosed series explores the case of one of those men.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C. at Clinton Peed PLC, and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Now, this is the first episode in a four-part series that's dealing with a possibly innocent man who sits on death row in Alabama. So I have been a crazy cat lady pretty much most of my life. I love cats. They relax me. I love that they're so independent. But of course, they cannot change their own litter. And that's always been kind of the hardest part.
The perfect cat.
The perfect cat.
If it could change its own litter. One day, science will give us that.
I have considered toilet training them. But until then, until that ever happens, we got to change our litter. And litter is a hassle. But it has not been ever since I switched to Pretty Litter, which I've been using for about a year now.
Yeah, Pretty Litter is amazing. It is Kitty Litter 2.0, and it's shipped right to your door in a small, lightweight bag that lasts the entire month. It's amazing.
It is. I mean, I know anybody who has a cat knows the experience of hauling like 60-pound bags of litter over your shoulder back home. It's awful. But these come in this little box, little bag. It lasts all month. And I've got two cats, by the way, it lasts for.
And the best part is it even monitors your cat's health. Pretty Litter changes colors to detect underlying illnesses before urgent medical care is needed, which saves you money, stress, and most importantly, potentially your cat's life.
Yeah, my 10-year-old actually updates us on the color of the litter and the cat pee like every week, which is great. It's great. We're all like, you know, keeping an eye on them. So look, do what we did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code undisclosed and you'll get 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed. About 87 miles north of Birmingham sits the city of Decatur in north-central Alabama on the shore of the Tennessee River. In 1991, a 68-year-old white woman named Ludie Mae Tucker lived in downtown Decatur at 506 Gordon Drive, Southwest. Tucker was a widow, but on the afternoon of October 4, 1991, she was being visited by her cousin, Mamie Marie Dutton. That afternoon, Tucker got a call from a guy she had been seeing, Tommy Drake, a.k.a. Shorty, who wanted to meet with her. Tucker agreed and she drove with Dutton to nearby Moulton, Alabama. Tucker dropped off Dutton at a restaurant called Steak and Biscuit where she had some tea while Tucker and Shorty got into an argument at the nearby Phillips 66 gas station. Tucker and Dutton then returned to Tucker's house where they watched some TV until Tucker got a call from her sister that ended at about 11 p.m. Tucker made the guest bed for Dutton and showed her her doll collection before Dutton went to sleep. A little while later, Dutton woke up at the sound of someone ringing the doorbell repeatedly.
So anyway then, I heard the doorbell ring and I thought, well, my goodness, Lene, can you not hear that doorbell, you know?
Right.
And I got up and I went to the door. And so when I got to the door from my bedroom, I seen her standing at the front door. And she had the blinds, you know, kind of pulled back. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, that was her boyfriend. They had been into it that night.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. What's his name?
They call him Shorty.
But the person at the door wasn't Shorty, or apparently anyone else that Tucker knew. Instead, it appeared to be a man in dire straits.
It was a colored guy. I recognized his voice. And he was a little short guy, like, and he had on blue pants and a white T-shirt.
Okay. When you say you recognized his voice, you mean?
I could tell he was colored by his way of talking.
From his voice,
yeah.
But if somebody...
See, he was just talking like a colored guy does, just real fast. And he said, well, he'd had a wreck, and he'd had a fight, and he was bleeding to death, and he'd need to get in touch with his family. And I hear Lou May asked him what was his number. And he said 3-something, I don't even remember. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, then by that time then, I could tell he was inside the house, which I thought, well, you know it. Everything was all right, you know. I didn't think about nothing like that happening, you
right.
know. And so I was just laying there in the bed. I went, got back in the bed, you know, after I seen she was at the door.
This audio is from a post-trial interview, but in an interview on October 7th, 1991, Dutton told police that the bleeding African-American man had given Tucker a phone number that started with numbers 353 to call his family. As Dutton notes, she believed the man's story and went back to bed, but she soon heard something that made her realize that something had gone horribly wrong.
And I hear to say, my husband's there in that room. And I know right then he done something suspicious, you know, for her to say that, you know. And so anyway then, well, now just in a few minutes then she started hollering, Marie, Marie.
Right.
Yeah. And I know right then he was doing something to her.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I just froze.
Well, sure, I'd be scared to death.
Ooh, I know it, Lord. That, well, I tell you, I still have them flashbacks.
I bet.
I do. They said I'd always have.
But while Dutton was frozen, the man wasn't. After he was done with Tucker, he ran to the bedroom where Dutton was staying.
And so he walks in, he runs
yeah,
around.
Yeah, he come around the round into the room. And see, I couldn't see because the door was back against the foot of the bed.
Right.
Then he run up to the side of my bed, and that's when he stabbed.
Okay. You said he had his, he just sort of came back?
Oh, he jogged back as far as he could like this right here.
With his right hand?
No, I don't even. Let's see.
The man fled the scene running out the front door, and Dutton came upon Tucker, dialing 911.
But anyway, when I got up and went to the door, she was sitting on the couch and had the phone. And now she had called cops herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying, hurry, hurry. Mm-hmm. And then I run to lock the front door, make sure he couldn't, you know, get back in.
Sure.
And when I looked around, she was gone. And I went down the hall, and she had went into the dining room, and she just passed out.
In that 911 call, Tucker spoke with police clerk Sherry Fulmer. Fulmer's records show that she received the call at 12:19 a.m., with Tucker telling her that a black male with a white shirt with blood on it had gotten to her house and stabbed her. Fulmer's records also show that she filled out a dispatch card at 12:20 a.m., with police dispatcher Alice Evans dispatching officers to Tucker's residence at 12:20 a.m. Now, luckily, Decatur police officer James Tilley had been patrolling an area only a couple blocks away since 12:14 a.m., so he was able to arrive at Tucker's residence within a couple minutes of the 12:20 dispatch. And Officer Howard Godby, who was also in the area, arrived a couple of minutes later. They were later joined by other officers, including John Boyd and James Rogers. Tucker and Dutton relayed their story to the officers about the short, stocky black male with a bloody white shirt, saying he'd been in a fight in a wreck, that he was bleeding to death, and that he needed to call his family, followed by the man stabbing both of them. Tucker and Dutton were taken to the hospital, and the officers dusted for fingerprints in the areas where the perpetrator might have left them. A palm print was lifted from the front door, and the officers would say they believe it was left by the suspect. Another print was lifted from a glass stereo door, where it looked like a missing VCR had been torn away from its connections at the TV and the cable decoder box. Finally, Officer Rogers noted that in the alley to the east of Tucker's house, there was some crushed down shrubbery and fresh footprints left in the dew on the ground that appeared to be headed from the south to north, or possibly from the north to south.
Tucker and Dutton were treated at the hospital. Tucker, who had been stabbed four times, did not survive her wounds. Dutton, who had been stabbed once in the side, was able to pull through. Over the next day, Decatur police officers spoke to neighbors without turning up any viable leads. Finally, Sergeant Johnny Coker and Investigator Gary Walker spoke with a man named Purcell Yarbrough about the crime and the theft of the VCR. This led to Yarbrough becoming concerned because he knew that his sister Annie Sue Crittenden ran a shot house just a few blocks north of Tucker's residence. So, what's a shot house? It was kind of an informal bar run out of a person's house. Here's Keith Russell, the defense investigator in this case.
Shot houses in this area was known for selling drinks by the shot glass, by the can, by the pint bottle, or even by the fifths. Most commonly were pint bottles of all different whiskeys, vodkas, rums, etc.
But it wasn't just alcohol that was sold at the shot house, and it wasn't just money that was used to make purchases.
You could get crack cocaine, marijuana in all quantities. You could also prostitution, you could buy women, and stolen goods of all types from TVs, VCRs were the hot items then, 8-track players had gone by the wayside, stereo equipment, boomboxes, and etc. That was the items that were very, very commonly wanted in this area and sold in this area.
So Yarbrough went to his sister's house and talked with her daughter, Vicki Bolden, who had been living there since her mother, Annie Sue, had become sick. Bolden told Yarbrough that a man had indeed brought over a VCR and traded it for crack. Bolden gave Yarbrough the VCR, which was in a bag, and Yarbrough brought the VCR to Sergeant Coker. With the VCR in hand, the Decatur police then tracked down the crack dealer at the shot house. His name was Leon Madden, and he went by the name Butch. Again, here's defense investigator Keith Russell.
Butch Madden was known as a police informant later on during this time. And he also was a drug dealer and a purveyor of goods, whatever they were. He was the man that you had to come to in this particular street, in this particular corner, and this street in order to conduct your business.
At the police station, Madden acknowledged selling crack in exchange for the VCR, but he denied having any knowledge of the seller. The next day, on Sunday, October 7th, Madden made a return visit to the police station with his right-hand man, Willie Reese Rabin, who went by the street name Roadrunner because he was able to outrun the cops. They both denied knowledge of the seller's identity.
A recent Gallup survey shows that Americans worry more about burglary than almost any other crime. More than mugging, more than terrorism, more than car theft and murder. According to studies, just over 10% of break-ins are planned beforehand. The rest are spur of the moment. Crimes of opportunity. In other words, random. And what's crazy is that only 1 in 5 homes has home security. Maybe because most companies really don't make it easy. They're expensive, they're confusing, it's a hassle. That's why I've used SimpliSafe for the past 2 years, and it's my top choice in home security. SimpliSafe protects your whole home, every window, room, and door, with 24/7 monitoring for just a fraction of the cost. Their police dispatch is up to 3.5 times faster because they use video verification. There's no contract, hidden fees, or fine print. It's designed to blend right into your home. No wires, no drilling. And it's easy to order. Easy to set up, usually in under an hour. SimpliSafe has won a ton of awards, from CNET to the New York Times Wirecutter. Prices are always fair and honest, and they have around-the-clock monitoring just $15 a month. So now you can visit SimpliSafe, undisclosed.com, and you'll get free shipping and a 60-day free trial. You've got nothing to lose. So go now, and be sure you go to SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com so they know we sent you. That's SimpliSafeUndisclosed.com.
Finally, that night, the Decatur police caught a break. An anonymous caller spoke with Investigator Walker and said that she had information about the killing. But after being told that she would have to testify in court, she hung up. Then, however, the same woman called back a few minutes later and spoke with Sergeant Coker. She said she lived near the crime scene and that, on the night of the murder, she had seen a man who went by the name Breeze in an alley that was only a block or two away from the crime scene. According to the caller, Breeze was bleeding from his hand and wiping blood in his white shirt, which had a logo on it. Breeze told her that he'd gotten into a fight with people over dope money and that they'd wronged him. Finally, Breeze asked her for a ride, which she refused, and within minutes of seeing Breeze, police were all over the area. A couple of days later, on Tuesday, October 8, 1991, there was a flurry of activity. First, in the morning, Sergeant Coker traced down the woman who made the anonymous call. Her name was Angela Acklin, and she lived one block west and 1.5 blocks south of Tucker's residence. According to Acklin, on the night of October 4th, her husband Rudolph and she were watching TV.
You know, kiddies, after a night of slithering through the sickening slime of my crawly crypt, I take a tip from the Marquis de Sade. He likes to unwind with a little red-hot poker.
That's the Crypt Keeper from HBO's Tales from the Crypt, which aired from 11 to 11:30 p.m. that night. Acklin told Coker that after the episode, her husband went to bed, and she went in and out of the house a couple times to her porch before hearing her dog crying. She then looked up 7th Avenue and saw a man she recognized as Breeze, or Cool Breeze, running across the street toward an alley that would have placed him just south of Tucker's house. Breeze was wearing black jeans and a white shirt with blood on it. Then, according to Acklin, she sat in her porch for a while before seeing a lot of police cars with lights arrive to the east. Acklin said she went to a friend's house and talked to her friend and her husband before heading to an alley that was just southwest of Tucker's house. There she says she saw Breeze again and asked him about the blood in his shirt. Breeze responded he had a misunderstanding with people about dope and said he had closed the door on his finger and heard it. Breeze asked her for a ride and she turned him down. Coker then returned at 12:50 p.m. and Acklin picked a man named Anthony Ballantyne out of a photo array. From there, things proceeded in short order. Again, here's defense investigator Keith Russell.
Within a few days of the murder, police connected a man named Anthony Cool Breeze Ballantyne to the scene and the murder. Three men had come forward stating that Ballantyne had pawned a stolen VCR.
The first of those men was Roadrunner, Willie Reese Rabin, Butch Madden's right-hand man. According to Roadrunner, Ballantyne came to the shot house at about 8 p.m. and bought a $20 rock of cocaine. Later, Ballantyne came back a second time and asked Butch about getting another rock on credit. When Butch turned him down, Ballantyne left but returned 1 to 1.5 hours later. Ballantyne came running up as if he were coming north from the vicinity of Tucker's house. Roadrunner said that Ballantyne was sweating and shaking all over with the VCR under his right arm. Valentine traded the VCR to Butch for a rock or two of cocaine, and Roadrunner then hassled Valentine about $5 he owed him from a prior drug deal. Raven's statement was completed at 4:10 p.m. For the police, this was enough to complete an arrest.
The police arrested a man named Anthony Kubrees Valentine, who worked at a local copper manufacturing plant.
Valentine was arrested at his workplace at 5:45 p.m. and interrogated by Sergeant Boyd and Jep Talent at 6:01 p.m. This interview led to the creation of a document by Sergeant Boyd called 21 Lies. It documents the 21 lies told by Valentine during this interview. Some of these include Valentine's claims that he stayed at home all night at his grandmother's house on October 4th, 1991, watching the Atlanta Braves game with her.
Second half, John Smoltz will pitch. And the Braves take the field.
The Braves did indeed play a game that night against the Houston Astros. But the police spoke with Valentine's grandmother, and she said that her grandson had been in and out all evening, and that he was not home when she finished watching the game and went to bed at 11:30 p.m. Another lie by Valentine was that he'd never used crack cocaine in his life. This lie was proven by the fact that urinalysis was done on Valentine that day, and it came back positive for cocaine. Two other lies by Valentine were that he didn't know Butch Madden and that he'd never been to the Shot House on October 4th. Roadrunner had already contradicted these claims, and Butch Madden had corroborated Roadrunner in a statement he'd given that same night. According to Madden, Valentine came to the Shot House the first time and bought a rock of crack after haggling over its size for a while. Valentine then left before coming back again and asking to buy more crack, this time on credit. Madden turned him down, and Valentine left before returning once again, walking in at a fast pace. He was sweating, shaking, talking fast, and acting paranoid. Under his right arm, Valentine had a VCR that he traded for two rocks of crack. Then, a few minutes later, police cars were all over the place. Madden closed his statement by saying, quote, "I hate it for Breeze, but I didn't make him do what he did." There was one seeming issue, though, with Breeze being the perpetrator of this crime. Both Tucker and Dutton had described the man that came to the house that night as short and stocky. But Valentine was listed by officers as 5'11 and 169 pounds. Whatever reservations, though, that the Decatur police might have had were quelled by what happened over the next few days.
So I was doing my facial routine and using my Tarte hydrator moisturizer thing, and I was like, oh my god, I'm almost out. And I had gotten it in my latest FabFitFun box. I gotta get some more.
The loofah. That's the one I'm always running out of.
Which one?
The loofah, like the scrubbing loofah thing. Oh my god, it's amazing.
I love that scrubbing loofah. Okay, look, everybody who's listening, we love our FabFitFun boxes. We use all the products that come every few months, and every time I open it, it's like Christmas. For somebody who doesn't celebrate Christmas, it's great.
It's like a present for you. You give yourself.
It is totally a present for me. I don't know about you, Susan, but I do love beauty products. I mean, I am one of those people. Taking a vacation is expensive. I don't buy fancy things for myself. I don't buy designer clothing. But I do like nice beauty products and makeup products. And I love the fact that FabFitFun sends you full-size products. You can try them if you love them. Like, we love so many of the things we've gotten. I jade roll my face all the time, by the way. You guys, you got to try it. Get a jade roller.
Well, so for me, I'm not a big beauty product buyer. So for me, it's like learning all the stuff I'm missing out on. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. Why didn't I buy this sooner?
Susan, I want to see you in a face mask. You got to tweet out that picture.
Oh God, it's not pretty. I think I did it wrong the first time. No, I know I did it wrong the first time. I've since learned.
How do you get a face mask wrong?
Oh, trust
me. I definitely need a picture of that. Okay. Well, I'll also say this, by the way. I've given FabFitFun as a gift to one of my best friends. For the last year, she's been getting the box. Every time she gets it, she takes a picture of herself with all the products in front of her and some of them on her, and she loves it. And I love it. It's just a gift that keeps on giving. It's fantastic. So FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box you get four times a year. It has full-size beauty, fashion, home, fitness, and wellness products, and it's only $49.99 a box, which is an incredible price.
These are full-size products, no samples of anything. Every box is guaranteed to have over $200 in retail value. And for the 2019 summer box total retail value, between $270 and $467, depending on which items you get.
And that box right now, the 2019 FabFitFun summer box, is actually on sale now, and they do run out, so y'all want to jump on that. And like we said, $49.99, many of the products alone are worth more than that. Incredible value.
Sign up for FabFitFun today. These boxes always sell out. Use our code undisclosed and get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code undisclosed to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use our code undisclosed to get $10 off your first order.
The next day, Wednesday, October 9th, 1991, officers executed a search warrant at Ballantyne's home. There, they found a knife with a broken yellow handle in Ballantyne's bedroom drawer and a laundry basket in that bedroom with several items of clothing, including blue work pants with paint in them and a white Oakland Athletics shirt with what appeared to be a blood stain on it. The shirt matched Ackland's description of Ballantyne wearing a white shirt with a logo and a blood stain. This takes us back to the list of 21 lies. According to Sergeant Boyd, while he was interrogating him, Ballantyne said, quote, "You can check my clothes. There ain't no blood in my clothes." To Boyd, this seemed like an incriminating statement, given that it wasn't public information yet that the victims had said the perpetrator had blood in his clothes. It was also a lie. Roger Morrison of the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences did testing on the Oakland A's shirt and determined that it did indeed have a blood stain. Testing revealed that this blood had an HLA DQ alpha type that excluded Tucker and Dutton, but was the same HLA DQ alpha type as Anthony Ballantyne. So what exactly is the HLA DQ alpha type? I reached out to Gary Harmer, the chief forensic serologist at the Serological Research Institute, which is where Morrison got his training.
But initially, in this early 1990s, there was only one PCR marker, and that's the HLA DQ alpha, and that's just the location of where the DNA is found in the human genome. So it was good, it was robust, and blood stains, and it could be tight for years. It did take a little bit more DNA than we use now, but it took 2 nanograms, and we usually use 1 nanogram now.
In this case, Morrison determined the blood stain and Ballantyne both had the HLA DQ alpha type 4,4. I asked Harmer what this meant.
Four major types in the HLA DQ alpha location that was tested for in this, and they're 1, 2, 3, 4. So everybody inherits one set of DNA from their mother and one set of DNA from their father, because the egg has half the amount of DNA to make a human and the sperm has half the amount. So when they fertilize, then it completes two sets of chromosomes. So the HLA DQ alpha, I believe, is on chromosome 6, So you inherit a type from your mother and a type from your father. And that's true of all the STRs, except for Y chromosomes, because there's only one of those. But you inherit two types. So in this case, he determined that the 4,4 was that they inherited 4 from their mother and 4 from their father.
So what's the likelihood that this was Ballantyne's blood? I found a case from the same time frame in which a criminalist had testified that 8.9% of the African American population had the HLA DQ alpha type 4,4. I followed up with the criminalist over email, and she confirmed this testimony and said that more advanced DNA testing could conclusively determine whether this was in fact Ballantyne's blood. There was also another finding by Morrison about the blood stain in the Oakland A's shirt. He said, quote, "This was basically a stain which the blood had saturated into the material of the garment. It was not a crusty stain, nor did it appear to be a wash stain." I asked Harmer whether this meant what I thought it meant.
Yes, what happens with people who bleed a lot in one spot is that the cloth becomes saturated, and then the liquid pools on top of the saturated cloth and then dries into a crust. So you can actually flake off pieces of crust from the fabric. Or if it's dried onto a piece of glass, which doesn't absorb any blood, then that turns crust into a crust, which you can just scrape off the glass. So that's what crust means. Now, that indicates that there wasn't a lot of pooling of blood on that garment. Now, when he says it didn't appear to be washed, washed blood stains are fainter than blood stains where if you bleed on a piece of cloth, it comes up red. You can see it fairly readily. It soaks into the fabric, but when you wash it, it fades away. And and becomes less apparent to the eye. So he was using his expertise in looking at the stain and saying, well, it doesn't have the appearance of being washed because it was fairly concentrated looking, but it wasn't too concentrated that it caused it to crust up.
So this was a blood stain that does not appear to have resulted from a lot of bleeding, and it was unwashed and in a laundry basket a few days after the murder. This lined up pretty well with Angela Ackland's claim of seeing Ballantyne with a white shirt with a logo with some blood on it from a cut to his hand around the time of the murder. It also lined up well with the statement the police would take the next day, October 10th, from a third man who claimed to have seen Ballantyne trading a VCR for crack on the night of the murder. That man was Larry Smith, who was dating Vicky Bolden, who, again, was the daughter of the owner of the shot house. Smith's story was largely the same as the story by Roadrunner and Butch. Ballantyne came to the shot house and bought a rock of crack. He then returned a second time and left after Butch said he didn't do credit. Later, Ballantyne came running around the corner of the house with a VCR under his arm. He was, quote, scary acting and looking around and behind him. Ballantyne then traded the VCR for two rocks of crack and left, followed by police cars arriving in the area about 10 to 15 minutes later. And finally, according to Smith, Ballantyne was wearing the Oakland A's shirt that the police had seized and dark pants. That same day, the Decatur police established another one of Ballantyne's 21 lies. This was Ballantyne's second attempt at an alibi after saying he was watching the Braves game with his grandmother all night. After this lie, Ballantyne said he only left to go to the house of his neighbor, James Watkins. But officers interviewed Watkins about the same time other officers were interviewing Smith. And according to Watkins, he had seen Ballantyne, but in the morning and early afternoon. He first saw Ballantyne at Ballantyne's place between 10 and 10:30 a.m., when the two drank some beers and talked. Later, Ballantyne came over to Watkins' place at about 3:30 p.m., and they talked and drank with some friends before Ballantyne left about 45 minutes later. Eventually, Watkins went to a barbecue with his wife between 7:30 and 8 p.m., and didn't return home until about 12:30 or 12:45 a.m., seeing the police cars and ambulances by the Tucker house as they went home.
Watkins said that he then listened to some music and fell asleep before someone knocked at his door a little while later. Watkins answered the door and had a conversation with a man who might have been Ballantyne, but Watkins was too drunk to remember. Later the same day, police also talked to a woman named Linda Wheeler, who'd known Ballantyne since junior high school and who worked with him. Wheeler said that Ballantyne had a drug problem, and he told her that he would walk across town at night because he got nervous and couldn't sleep. She also said that Ballantyne was broke a lot, but she'd heard he'd been saving some money. The next day, October 11th, the police then spoke to a woman named Maggie Smith, who'd known Ballantyne for 30 years. According to Smith, Ballantyne was kind of a Jekyll and Hyde. He was nice when he was clean, but when he started using drugs, he, quote, became a different person, and was mean, violent, high-strung. Maggie Smith also said that his crack habit led him to owing every drug dealer in Decatur. Not long after this, the Decatur police got records from a prior repair of Tucker's VCR, and those records confirmed that the VCR retrieved from the shot house was indeed Ludie Mae Tucker's VCR. This was seeming like an open and shut case. The prosecutor took it to the grand jury, and Sergeant Boyd took the stand and testified that he was confident that they had the right man, that Anthony Cool Breeze Ballantyne was the man who had killed Ludie Mae Tucker.
Now, we open this episode with the concept of residual doubt, and at this point, you might be a lot like Sergeant Boyd, confident in the guilt of Mr. Ballantyne and not harboring much in the way of residual doubt. But Anthony Ballantyne is not the man who sits in death row for the murder of Ludie Mae Tucker, and he's not the man who could be told any day now that he has 30 days until the state of Alabama will execute him with a secretive lethal injection protocol. That man is Robin Rocky Myers, Ludie Mae Tucker's neighbor who lived just across the street to Tucker on the north of her house. This is his story, and maybe the story of how you can help save the life of an innocent man, next time on Undisclosed.
Thank you.
big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Delahan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is at Undisclosed Pod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.